Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Helper.
I'm Aaron Mattei. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here. Our website, as always, is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content as we head into the Trump administration part two. And what an exciting week as Trump has rolled out all of his picks for his cabinet. And in short, the TLDR is, this is not make America great again. This is make Israel great again, as one after one, Trump's picks for top posts are all fanatic supporters of Israeli apartheid. Someone like Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, doesn't even recognize Palestinians as like a real thing. He won't even call the West Bank. He calls it Judea and Samaria. So we are in for a very grim 4 years ahead.
Of course, we should give a shout out to Bill Clinton, who also uses those terms, as he did during a stump speech for Kamala Harris in Michigan. So it's always a great sign when Bill Clinton and Mike Huckabee share the same nomenclature.
It's true. Trump could have appointed Bill Clinton as ambassador to Israel, yeah, and it wouldn't have made a big difference.
Right. Well, we're going to get to the four basic food groups because there may be a change in administration coming down the pike, but something that doesn't change is our show, because we're keeping it real for you guys. So for Democrats Suck, you guys may remember that around 30 days ago, the U.S. sent a letter to Israel saying it had 30 days to improve and boost aid into Gaza or else it would face consequences. Well, 30 days are up. And according to humanitarian rights groups, Israel has not only failed to meet the U.S. criteria, but it is taking actions that dramatically worsen the situation on the ground, and particularly in northern Gaza. So here we have Secretary of State Antony Blinken trying to justify why the U.S. won't actually do anything about this, despite giving Israel a deadline.
The intent was to inject a sense of urgency with Israel to take necessary steps to address the dire humanitarian situation of children, women, and men in Gaza. The effect has been that of the 15 steps that we urged action on, Israel has taken action, either in implementing or in being in the process of implementing 12 of the 15 steps.
Okay, that's, I guess, great news, but they didn't ask for 12 steps. They asked for 15 steps. They said they had 30 days to implement these 15 steps, and they didn't do anything about it. Okay.
Yeah, so and again, also, yeah, it's like, it's one or the other. Either you've implemented a step or you haven't. There's right. No in the process of
right, exactly.
A step.
Yeah,
if you're in the process of implementing a step, that means you have not implemented it.
Right.
And he doesn't specify out of those 12 steps that he says have either been implemented or in the process of implemented, how many are in the process of being implemented.
Right.
In which, but by that, I assume he means that Israel said, yeah, we're going to do it.
Right.
We're going to do it, which, of course, they had 30 days, a grand 30 days to do, which they're not. So this is all a fig leaf. Blinken is, it's just unbelievable how he can get up in front of reporters and pretend as if a starvation siege has not been eased when it's there for the world to see. As you mentioned, all the aid groups involved have said that the siege has gotten worse. There's almost no aid getting in to Gaza, no aid getting into northern Gaza, which is where the siege was most acute. And he gets up there, and this is his way of shifting it by saying, Israel is in the process of taking some steps that they just haven't actually implemented yet.
You know, I've often said that Israel is like the enabled, spoiled child of the United States. And here we see a clear example of the parent, the father of the United States, not being able to set any boundaries for its child, except imagine the child is genocidal and the father is encouraging and helping the genocide. Because, you know, any parent knows this. You can't set make an ultimatum and then go back on it. You can't set rules. You can't tell your kid if you don't do your homework, there will be consequences. And then your kid doesn't do their homework and then you don't put out any consequences. I mean, you can do that, but you're not going to change the behavior. You're literally enabling them. Not that I'm an encouragement. I'm more into positive reinforcement than punishment when you're raising kids. But again, there's a difference between a genocidal state and children. So my comparison only goes so far. So let's go back to hear more Blinken. Sorry about this, guys.
There are three big issues that still need to be addressed that come from the letter.
What's the point in having a deadline if after the deadline passes and Israel does nothing, you then say, well, there are still big issues that have to be addressed?
Right.
So, in other words, your deadline means nothing.
Right.
Because either you stick to your deadline and your demand, right, or you don't. If they don't meet your demand by the deadline, you don't say, well, they still have to meet they still have to address some issues. No.
Right.
They didn't meet your deadline. So, what are the consequences?
Right.
And the consequences are zilch, because what they should have done, and they should have done this from the start, is cut off weapons, any aid whatsoever to Israel, because Israel's in violation of international law just by virtue of the fact that it's occupying Gaza, right, and the West Bank. And then on top of that, now committing genocide there for more than a year.
I would note, though, as well, that it's extraordinary to me that as from almost day one, there is no focus on Hamas, and almost deafening silence around the world on Hamas. Not only has it rejected engaging on the hostage ceasefire proposals, not only has it rejected even smaller proposals that would have cost it nothing to release a small number of hostages and actually have Palestinian prisoners released from Israeli jails in return. Not only that, but a couple of weeks ago, Israel said, we will guarantee safe passage for every Hamas militant out of Gaza. Just give us the hostages back. And they refused. Is anyone talking about that? The world's been silent on that too. So it would be good to also see some genuine, sustained, effective pressure on Hamas to do its part to end something that it started, and that the Palestinian people who were caught in this crossfire of Hamas's initiation didn't start and themselves are powerless to stop.
Wow. So, guys, why won't the world talk about Hamas? Why won't the world put any blame on Hamas? That's something I've been asking myself every day, especially the United States and Western countries, Western governments. It's just unbelievable that first, of course, they do the thing where October 7th is the beginning of history, as if that happened in a vacuum. As Guterres, of the UN, said, it did not happen in a vacuum. And after he said that, Israel deemed him persona non grata, even though it's such an undeniable statement. And here you have it again. The United States, which lies about Hamas's willingness to come to the table, which lies about the way Israel has sabotaged the talks, pretending that it's Hamas's fault, and then pretending that no one is blaming Hamas.
There's a lot there. This claim of a safe passage offer to Hamas was in the Wall Street Journal. Let's assume it's true. Hamas launched October 7th because they wanted to free Palestinian prisoners that are held in Israeli dungeons. And also, they wanted some movement towards the fundamental problem here, which is the denial of Palestinian self-determination. And so now, let's assume Israel actually made this offer of safe passage. They're not just going to accept a deal that grants them safe passage to leave in exchange for the hostage freedom, because, you know, they're a resistance group fighting a occupation, now a genocide. And having launched October 7th, having seen the massive price that Gaza has paid for October 7th, they are not going to voluntarily just leave and give everything up just for the right to leave. They want something done for the fundamental problem, which is Palestinian freedom. And that is what Blinken refuses to acknowledge. For him, there's no illegal military occupation. There's no decades-long siege. There's no ethnic cleansing that began all of this in 1948, which Palestinians want to see addressed, because, you know, you now have millions of people around the world, both in Palestine and outside of it, who are refugees and the descendants of refugees. And they want their rights. They want some minimal recognition of their rights, which Israel and the U.S. have stood alone in blocking. And Blinken, as essentially an appendage of the Israeli government, just completely obscures all of that by making this about Hamas. And again, if we're talking about offers, Hamas actually offered early on, before Israel invaded, back in October 2023, to free all the captives if Israel agreed not to invade Gaza, which Israel immediately rejected. And Blinken is never mentioned because his job is to cover up for Israel, not to bring peace to that region.
Really just disgusting. And anyone who's honest about what has happened knows that Netanyahu is the one who's sabotaging the ceasefire and the return of hostages. And you don't have to, you can just go to the Israeli media to find people saying that.
Yeah, what you can't find in the U.S. media is awareness of two scandals that Netanyahu is now facing. The first one is that his office apparently passed forged documents to friendly media outlets to make it look as if Hamas was blocking a ceasefire, and that Hamas would basically, some fake documents basically saying that Hamas was saying that they're never going to release the hostages. So therefore, the takeaway was it's fine for Israel to keep committing mass murder in Gaza because they're not going to, Hamas will not free the hostages anyway.
Anyway,
that's one scandal. That's one. And the second scandal is that Netanyahu's office is being accused of trying to blackmail people to not disclose that Netanyahu received warnings ahead of October 7th that it was coming. These are two huge scandals that raise new questions about Netanyahu, not only in his failure to prevent October 7th and his possible, you know, awareness that it was coming, and then also committing a scam to prolong the massacre in Gaza and to avoid the release of the captives. So nothing mentioned here in the U.S. media about this yet, except for at the usual places, like, you know, people like Seymour Hersh have been writing about this, but nothing because it undermines the narrative that Antony Blinken wants us to believe.
Here's a related clip, some more Democrats sucking, and here is how Vedant Patel of the State Department attempts to run interference for the Biden administration and the failure to implement any consequences despite these deadlines. Let's take a look.
Why did you bother to put in 350 trucks a day if it doesn't matter?
I'm not going to speak to the...
I mean, you keep saying you're not going to speak to specific metrics, but you guys are the ones that made this specific. We didn't. We didn't give the Israelis 30 days to do all this stuff. You guys did. And now those 30 days are up. And as you heard from everyone so far, and these aid groups that came out last night, they haven't met them. And all of a sudden you say that the metrics that you put out don't matter.
I never said that they don't matter. What I said was
rabbit hole. I mean, these are metrics exactly like you put out. It's not a rabbit hole.
Meaning I don't want to take up time getting into a specific tit for tat on like truck numbers.
Well, why did you let them in the letter?
You can't take
those metrics. The metrics and the number of, let me just be very clear. The metrics and the number of trucks getting into Gaza every day absolutely matter. I said that to him because I did not want to get into a specific technical conversation on inflows and outflows. I don't have more updated numbers for you beyond the ones what I said to Tom.
Okay, so there you have it. They're literally saying you said that Israel had to let in a certain number of trucks. They haven't let in those trucks, and you're not implementing any of the consequences that you said you would do. And Patel's response to this is that it's going down a rabbit hole to talk about the number of trucks.
The metrics matter. We're just not going to do anything about them.
Right.
So, right. Yes, we're not dismissing that there is a number of trucks that are not getting in, carrying vital life-saving aid. We're just not going to do anything about the metrics that we imposed.
Right, exactly.
So they matter, but we're not going to do anything about them. What kind of a person takes this job?
I know.
You have to go up every single day in front of the media who are like, just like, pulling their hair out because they're being gaslit constantly and lied to. And you have to like speak in all this constant Orwellian doublespeak language where you're constantly justifying not sticking to the demands that you laid out and the things you said you care about.
Right. You're just admitting that there's literally zero credibility and there are no from the US government and there are no red lines. And that you will say that things are red lines and you say that things have to be implemented and then they're not done and you don't do anything about it. And if you ask about that, you dare ask about that, then you are going down a rabbit hole. I hope this guy's in therapy. I mean, not that they deserve to be adjusted or happy, but it must be. Can you imagine going to therapy about this and talking about how hard it is? You're like, oh, my God. Then I have to figure out how to lie to them about this. Then I have to figure out how to lie to them about that. It's just the stress is getting to me, Doc.
I mean, imagine being their therapist. You'd have to be a really empathetic person to take that case.
Right. Yeah.
You know, how to counsel a sociopath.
Right.
But hey, everyone deserves therapy. And certainly maybe if some of these people had it, they wouldn't be up there podium.
So those are just just two examples of Democrats sucking. What do we got for Republicans?
For Republicans suck, let's turn to the cabinet so far of Donald J. Trump. Now, right after Trump got elected, he excited some people, including, I have to say, yours truly, who got a little duped here when Trump put out this tweet about who would not be joining his administration. I will not be inviting former Ambassador Nikki Haley or former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to join the Trump administration, says Donald Trump. And I thought to myself, wow, could this possibly mean that Trump is recognizing that surrounding himself with neocons is not only like terrible policy, it's just bad politically. And so therefore announcing this publicly is a sign that he's maybe turning away from the neocons that dominated his first administration. Well, what's the term? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Well, shame on me, because it turns out this was yet another classic Trump con, and that Trump basically announced that two neocons from his past administration won't be joining his new administration. But don't worry, his new administration will be filled with the same sort of neocons. And just to underscore this, Nikki Haley then confirmed that she had been approached by the Trump team and asked about working in the administration, but she said she didn't want the job.
Everything I've ever said, I stand by it. That's what I meant. I had no interest in being in his cabinet. He knew that. But to go a little further, his best friend, Steve Witkoff, came to our house in South Carolina, spoke to me and my husband, and basically wanted a truce between me and Donald Trump. And I told him at the time there was no truce needed, that I had, that Trump had my support. There was no issues on my end. And at that point, he was like, what do you want? Tell me what you want. Is there anything you want? And I said, there's nothing I want. And there wasn't anything I wanted. And then several weeks back, I talked to Howard Lutnick, his transition director, and he asked, you know, if I knew of people that would be good in the cabinet, if there was any insight. And what I said is, I think it's really important that Trump surround himself with people that are going to tell him the truth. And I, you know, mentioned someone that I thought would be good for Commerce Secretary, and mentioned that I thought the UN ambassador should be a cabinet pick. But I did not ask anything for me, and I have made it clear to everyone that I was not interested in the administration.
Okay, so Trump announces that Nikki Haley will not be joining his administration. Meanwhile, Nikki Haley has previously told him she doesn't want to be a part of his administration.
That's why she's not joining it, right? Because she doesn't want to, not because Trump isn't inviting her.
Exactly right. Exactly, yeah. Right. So,
you know, going back to the kid analogy, it's kind of like, imagine if you're having a party and you ask someone if they can come to your party and they're like, no, I don't want to come to your party. I can't come to your party. I'm not coming to your party. And then you're like, I'm not inviting Jessica to my party.
Exactly right. That's exactly what it is. Trump's con continues because, you know, recall he took advantage of the fact that Democrats were facilitating a genocide in Gaza and were campaigning with the Cheneys to say he was the president of peace, right? He was the peace candidate. Well, who is the president of peace appointing as his ambassador to Israel? Somebody who basically says that the Palestinian people don't even exist. And that is Mike Huckabee. Here is one of many clips that are circulating of Mike Huckabee explaining his extremist evangelical views about Palestine.
Basically, there really is no such thing as, and I have to be careful in saying this, because people will really get upset, there's really no such thing as a Palestinian.
There's not. Before 1948, there was all Arabs.
Arabs and Persians. You don't have, you know, and there's such complexity within that. There's really no such thing. That's been a political tool to try to force land away from Israel. Well, my point is, if that's the issue, if it's real estate, if you look at a map and say, here's how much Israel has, and here's how much the Arab states hold, there's plenty of land for them to have, you know, let them take it out of Egypt, let them take it out of Syria, let them take it out of Jordan. There are plenty of places for this to be without sacrificing the Golan Heights, which would be suicide. Suicide. And what worries me is, I mean, we've got to respect Israel's decisions to self-govern. But when I hear some of their leaders talking about giving up the Golan Heights, I'm thinking.
In that clip, if, in case you couldn't hear it, Huckabee is saying there's no such thing as the Palestinian people. They're basically an invention because they're all just Arabs. So, you know, what are Palestinians? And then he says, if you want to give Palestinians a state, there's plenty of land for them to do it in. They can do it in Syria and Jordan, you know, which is a long time, you know, right wing Israeli talking point. The Palestinians already have a state. It's in Jordan, and they can go, you know, to any Arab country because they're all just Arabs anyway. I mean, honestly, if we're going to use that argument, it actually applies to Israel itself. When Israel, when the Zionists wanted to create a state, there was already a people in the land they wanted to create their state in, and that was called Palestine. And early Zionists recognized this. Jabotinsky, an early Zionist leader, said that, you know, there already are Arabs there. So if we're going to create a state, we have to take it by force because the indigenous people of the land are not going to welcome us there, taking their land and making it ours. So what Zionists could have done is picked an empty land or picked like, I don't know, a place like, I don't know, Long Island or something like that to settle and not try to forcibly displace people. But Mike Huckabee, who supports forcible displacement, supports ethnic cleansing, now says, or was saying back in 2008, and presumably he still believes this, the Palestinians, if they want a state, they can just go to some other Arab state. It's just pure racism, pure contempt, and that's who Trump has chosen to be his ambassador to Israel.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that the Zionists had to lie and say that Israel was a, and I put that in air quotes for people just listening to the audio, that, you know, what was at that point, and still is, Palestine, was a land without a people for a people without a land. And unfortunately, it was actually a land with a lot of people that was going to be stolen by people who said they didn't have a land.
So let's keep it going. Who else is sort of supposed anti-neocon, anti-war Trump picking for his cabinet? Well, his pick for defense secretary is a Fox News host and veteran named Pete Hegseth. Here he is in 2016 talking about the Iraq War. Now, the Iraq War was a heavy factor in Trump's campaign in 2016, where he campaigned against the Iraq War. He, you know, sort of destroyed Jeb Bush's candidacy by pointing to the Bush administration's complicity in destroying the Middle East by invading Iraq and all the consequences it had. Well, here is Trump's defense secretary nominee, Pete Hegseth, in 2016, talking about the Iraq War.
The Iraq War is an example of what America got right when we got it right. When we showed resolve in the face of a difficult moment, in a dark moment, when we knew we weren't doing it right, we doubled down, defeated an enemy, crushed the enemy. And Joe Biden in 2011 said it would be a resounding success.
So there's Pete Hegseth agreeing with Joe Biden that the U.S. was right to invade Iraq and right to occupy it, right to destroy it. And presumably he also supports the fact that it led to the rise of ISIS and all the horror that that has all caused throughout the world. So that is Trump's nominee for defense secretary, Pete Hegseth.
And, you know, it's also relevant that not only did Trump run against Jeb Bush by using the failure of the Iraq War and the disastrous outcome and fallout of the Iraq War, he recently skewered Kamala Harris for campaigning alongside Liz Cheney for having her stump for her and appear with her by pointing out how many people the Iraq War had killed. And of course, Dick Cheney was the architect of that Iraq War. So he's just, contradicting himself left and right. And that is built into who Trump is. So he gets to get away with that. And, you know, he definitely knows that running as an anti-war candidate is the right thing to do, but he's not going to govern like that as an anti-war president.
All right. And meanwhile, he's also picked for his national security advisor, a guy named Mike Waltz, who, funnily enough, just speaking on of this theme of the Bush administration, funnily enough, Mike Waltz happened to work for none other than Vice President Dick Cheney as a counterterrorism advisor. And Michael Tracy pointed this out. And Michael Tracy, by the way, has been doing an amazing job just exposing the fallacy of Trump claiming to be anti-war. Mike Tracy pointed out that in announcing Mike Waltz, Trump's announcement didn't, you know, in listing Mike Waltz's biography, it omitted the part where Mike Waltz worked for Vice President Dick Cheney. And if you're going to get someone's
biography, that's just because he's really humble. He doesn't want to brag.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you think if you're announcing someone's biography and they've worked for the vice president, right, in another White House, you would put that in a biography.
Relevant, yeah.
But the Trump team apparently felt that it was prudent to leave that out. And it just shows what a fraud they are in claiming to be anti-neocon, anti-deep state, anti-war. And it's a con they're pulling for the second time because the same thing happened in 2016. As we talked about, Trump ran a set of anti-interventionists, appointed some of the most hardcore interventionists there are, people like John Bolton. Right. Okay, one more clip of Trump's nominees. You know, his Secretary of State is going to be Marco Rubio. We all know from this show who Marco Rubio is, you know, hardcore neocon. Funnily enough, you know, Trump ran against migrants, right? Blaming undocumented immigrants for America's problems. Well, Marco Rubio is someone responsible for a large number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. because what did he do? He pushed Trump to launch a coup in Venezuela impose crippling sanctions that they knew would destroy Venezuela's economy, would force people to flee. They were warned about this explicitly. This came out earlier this year in the Washington Post, that they received explicit warnings that their sanctions in Venezuela would create migrants. They did it anyway. And then Trump goes ahead and then demonizes the very migrants who he helped create in the first place. And Marco Rubio, because he wanted to encourage people to flee Venezuela to collapse its economy further, he helped push through TPS, temporary protected status, for Venezuelans, which the U.S. does when it's trying to overthrow a government. They allow TPS for people fleeing their own regime change efforts. They've done this in Nicaragua. They've done this in Haiti. This is the playbook. If you're fleeing a country that the U.S. is trying to overthrow, odds are there'll be a TPS for a while it's politically convenient. And of course, people who are fleeing horrible regimes that we support, they do not get TPS because right. we want them to stay and suffer under the people that we're backing. That's Marco Rubio. But let's go to one more nominee. This is John Ratcliffe, who is Trump's nominee for director of the CIA. And here he is speaking to Fox News about how essentially the U.S. should be backing Israel even more passionately and extensively than the Biden administration has.
And, you know, I think it larger at play here, Maria, is not just this short-term election, but that it really reveals the failed strategy of the Democrats over the last 10 years in dealing with Iran. You know, the famous Obama doctrine, which was that, look, we can deter Iran diplomatically and it won't come at the expense of Israel. Well, Barack Obama was wrong. He misunderstood the lethality and the evil nature of the Iranian regime. And what Israel has done is essentially employ the Trump doctrine, a pressure, maximum pressure campaign, understanding that the only way to deter terrorists like Iran and their proxies is to put your foot on their throat. And Israel has done that. We should be assisting Israel in doing so. But again, political expediency and the quest for power by Kamala Harris and the Democrats is resulting in American national security taking a back seat, unfortunately.
That's quite disturbing.
Yeah, it is quite disturbing. It's disturbing that people like this are in charge of national security jobs where their criticism of the Biden administration that supported genocide, that refused to re-enter their own nuclear deal, which they previously under Obama negotiated with Iran. The criticism from Ratcliffe is that somehow Biden is soft on Israel, in supporting Israel. And it's just an absolute nightmare that these are the people who Trump wants running his national security.
Right. Also, give Israel some credit. It's not implementing a Trump doctrine. I mean, they have a very long history of sadistic doctrine, including the Dahiya doctrine, which is very homegrown, has nothing to do with Donald Trump. So give them credit for their own homegrown, sadistic, draconian, human rights violating and lethal policies, please.
Well, maybe that's what we can hope for, you know, is a conflict between Israel and the Trump administration over who is a more like fanatic supporter of Israel.
Right.
And who is a more fanatic supporter of aggression. And maybe that will lead to tension between the two. They'll have a falling out. And maybe that will get someone to reconsider the whole thing if they have an argument over who is like a more of a hardcore Israel Israel firster.
And then in a perfect world, Trump will be like, all right, well, I was an Israel firster, but you don't think I am. So I'm not going to support you anymore.
Very, very bleak. Very bleak. Yeah. What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
So for Isn't That Weird, here is a clip of an Israeli journalist who asks Biden if he thinks he can get a hostage deal done by the end of the term. Now, I'm going to tell you what he says because it's pretty hard to understand. But his response is, because apparently there are a lot of camera people in the room, his response is, do you think that you can get hit in the head by the camera behind you? So let's watch this.
President Biden, do you think that you can get a hostage deal by the end of your term?
You think you're going to get hit in the head by the camera behind you? All right.
So not really sure what the connection is between being able to get a hostage deal and being able to get hit in the head by a camera. Not sure if he's threatening her or if he's actually concerned with her physical safety, but it certainly is a weird moment. I think that could have also qualified for a stoned moment, but I chose to do it for a weird. Yeah, I don't really know what he's talking about there.
I forget sometimes that he's still around.
Right.
You know, he only pops up to do a photo op with Trump. as he did the other day in welcoming Trump at the White House. And by the way, what happened to like Trump being a fascist who's going to be the next Hitler? And then you have the current president of the, you know, who also heads the Democratic Party that's been lodging all these claims about Trump, you know, smiling with him and, you know, ready to pass the baton. You know, as we talked about on this week's Thursday Throwdown, if you really think the guy is a fascist, why are you welcoming to the Oval Office to ensure a smooth transition?
Right. He as you termed it, Aaron, he's getting a fash pass.
He's getting a fash pass.
Which means two things. It's both when you get a pass for being a fascist, and it's also when you pass the baton to a fascist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for isn't that terrible, let's turn to Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is not happy about two of Trump's picks for the cabinet. She's not upset about Marco Rubio, who is her Senate colleague, even though Marco Rubio has supported policies around the world that have caused so much carnage and horror. She's mad about Matt Gaetz, who Trump has chosen to head the Justice Department. And, you know, Matt Gaetz is definitely an off-the-wall choice. He's a young guy, you know, trained as a lawyer, but aside from that, not much legal experience. He served in the House. And, you know, Trump is clearly signaling that he's going to reward Gaetz' loyalty by appointing him. And Gaetz, meanwhile, is you know, facing a scandal around allegations of having sexual relations with a minor, which is still developing as we speak. But she's also mad about Tulsi Gabbard. And Tulsi Gabbard is a former Democratic Congress member, resigned from the DNC when it was caught essentially rigging the primary for Bernie Sanders, has taken some positions that really anger people in Washington because she's very critical of the proxy wars in Syria and Ukraine. I'm personally critical of Tulsi Gabbard because she's a supporter of Modi in India. And you know, recently she's been a fanatic supporter of the Israeli government in committing mass murder. And she's demonized the you know brave college protesters who've opposed the genocide.
Islamism is very directly a political Islam whose goal is world domination under Islamic law. That is the goal of groups like Hamas and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others. So we have to be very clear about that. Unfortunately, what we're seeing on our college campuses are not these protests actually truly calling for peace, understanding the dangers of the situation there. They have become puppets of this radical Islamist organization that stands diametrically opposed to our ideology of freedom. And unfortunately, President Biden, he seems to be afraid of being called an Islamophobe, which is why he's shirking away from a very clear statement of standing against anti-Semitism, for free speech, and against this radical Islamist ideology.
But for people in Washington, Tulsi Gabbard is a red flag because she's actually been right on some of the key issues, I think, including opposing or at least raising questions about the proxy wars in Ukraine and Syria. So here is Elizabeth Warren voicing her objections to Tulsi Gabbard in a very familiar way. But guess what? Accusing her of being in Russia's pocket.
Many things I disagree with Marco Rubio on, and I haven't decided yet about voting for him, but he is qualified. He has experience. We may have differences that would cause me to say, I don't think that he should be Secretary of State. And we'll go through that. We'll listen to the hearings. I want to hear very carefully from him. But what we're talking about with people like Matt Gaetz is very different from what we're talking about with people like Marco Rubio. And we just have to keep that in mind. But do understand with Matt Gaetz, and you've already made this point, he's not the only one out there who is unqualified and who raises whole questions like Tulsi Gabbard does. You really want her to have all of the secrets of the United States and our defense intelligence agencies when she has so clearly been in Putin's pocket? That just has to be a hard no.
So there we go. And we've heard this ad nauseum since 2016. Here's yet another political opponent of establishment Democrats being accused of being in the pocket of Russia. Hillary Clinton also did this about Tulsi Gabbard as well. Just putting aside how dumb this is to accuse anyone you don't like of being a Russian agent, like how has this worked out for you politically? Okay. Democrats went all in on the Russiagate conspiracy theory. They went all in on Mueller time. That was a complete embarrassment. It totally collapsed. They did this again in 2020 with the Hunter Biden laptop, the Hunter Biden laptop was embarrassing for the Bidens. So they just accused that of being also the work of Russia. that also was a lie. And the thing is, people don't forget this. When you frame the president of being a Russian agent and you accuse voters of being manipulated by Russia, and that's why they voted for Trump or didn't vote for Hillary or didn't vote for Kamala Harris, there's going to be resentment. And Democrats, by not addressing that, because Russiagate was just too big to fail, they keep doubling down on the strategy of accusing anyone you don't like of being a Russian agent. And it's going to wear thin by now. And people are actually, I think, going to be offended by it beyond those of us who've been calling this out for a long time. So even as a political strategy, I really think they ought to rethink what they're doing here in adopting essentially a McCarthyite approach.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. And, you know, I got to say, I got to hand it to them. I mean, I think this is evidence of what you're saying. A lot of the Democratic machine that is looking for excuses for why Kamala Harris lost, excuses that have anything and that are about anything except for what she did or what Biden did, even they aren't really pushing the Russia thing. So, Warren, you're out of step. This is the talking point of last season and the season before that.
Yeah, 2024, it's got to go out of style, just for your own political sake.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, and that has been a very transition-themed for basic food groups.
Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now, but if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish Moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. We are so excited to be speaking to Tara Kabash and Josh Paul. They are co-founders and co-directors at A New Policy, which is a lobbying organization advocating for just U.S. policy towards Palestine and Israel. You can find out more about that organization at anewpolicy.org. Tara Kabash served as a political appointee and policy advisor in the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development. He was the second government official and the first political appointee to publicly resign from the Biden administration due to its policy on Gaza. Josh Paul resigned from the State Department in October 2023 due to his disagreement with the Biden administration's decision to rush lethal military assistance to Israel in the context of its war on Gaza. He had previously spent over 11 years working as a director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs. And now, without further ado, Tara Kabash and Josh Paul. Thank you so much, Josh and Tarek. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So we're going to get into the political developments of the day, obviously. But before we do that, can you just explain to people what role you played in the Biden administration and what made you feel the need to resign?
Sure. Okay, I'll kick off on that. So I served in the State Department in something called the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, which is responsible for U.S. arms transfers and security assistance. And so I resigned in mid-October. October 18th was my last day of 2023, because there was this flood of requests of Israel coming in for more weapons. But at that point, we'd already seen over 3,500 Palestinians killed in Gaza. And when I tried to raise concerns in that space, because I don't believe, and I don't think honestly that anyone working there believes that the purpose of U.S. arms and the purpose of providing U.S. arms to partners is to kill thousands of civilians. But there was no willingness on the part of the Biden administration or the Blinken State Department to have that conversation. And indeed, there still isn't. But I thought that this was an important conversation to be had. And if I couldn't have it within the State Department, it was important to bring it to the American people. And that's what I've spent the last year doing.
Yeah. So I was in the Department of Education's policy office, known as the Office for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development. I led a lot of the interagency work that the Department of Education was doing, interacting with the White House, with OMB, with, Department of Labor, in instances where it interacted, and many other federal agencies. At the same time, I led a lot of the regulatory policy drafting and the budget development process as well on higher education issues in particular. So whatever is happening on college campuses, however the Department of Education is trying to, address racial equity issues in education, opportunity gaps for students who are being able to access or afford higher education, that was really the purview of what I was working in. And similarly to Josh, I think, once we saw the really systemic aggression by the Israeli government against Palestinian civilians, and when it was very clear that the administration was not going to really shift in its approach to provide unconditional weapons, unconditional financial support, unconditional support for the aggression against civilians, when we saw the president, dispute the number of casualties of Palestinian civilians, when we saw justification for an invasion into a hospital because of intel that no one ever really saw and we just kind of had to accept, it was very clear from a political perspective that there was no real interest in slowing down the war machine, no real interest in actually holding the Israeli government accountable. And as a political official, I was a political appointee within the Biden administration. It felt really hard to separate myself and my role from what the administration was doing, even though I was not working on the day-to-day of what was happening in Palestine, in Gaza. And insofar as I was trying to do the work to help college students here at home and seeing, distress from students who are Arab, who are Muslim, who are Palestinian, who are progressive Jewish students, Black students, seeing that on college campuses, seeing students start to speak out against what the U.S. government was signing off on, we started having conversations inside the Department of Education. It became very clear the White House was really uninterested in entertaining any sort of action by the Department of Education, any sort of regulatory guidance to institutions, Dear Colleague letters, even using the bully pulpit. It was clear that the Department of Education didn't have a real role to play because there was no political will for that to happen. And so I resigned because I could not be effective in my job anymore, given all of the political barriers that were making it impossible to do that work.
And you, of course, are Palestinian American. Can you talk about how that perhaps shaped your perspective and also your experience of the Biden administration's policies?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a Palestinian American. I was born and raised here in the United States, but I'm a descendant of, Palestinians on both sides. Both my parents are first generation immigrants. And so for me, that played a really significant part in my worldview, my understanding of the region, my personal experiences. And as a political appointee, I think it was, important for me to talk about my identity. The president always talked about wanting to have a administration that reflected what America really looked like. Well, there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in the diaspora living in the United States, just based on just information that we have, that number could be substantially higher. There are millions of Arab Americans that are living here in the United States. And that is something that, I think needs to be represented, but not just to have numbers, not just to check those boxes. Yes, we have a Palestinian American who is part of the political administration. It's about leveraging the experience, the knowledge, the history to be able to set and adhere to policies with that knowledge. And that was the gap that we never really saw filled once the administration was set on those policies. It was clear from the beginning it was policies that were determined by a very small number of old white guys that, they said this is what's going to happen, this is what the policy is going to look like. And no amount of communicating from the community, from staff, from anywhere was going to change that.
And since both of you have resigned, we've seen reports that Antony Blinken was given explicit warnings from his own experts that Israel was blocking aid into Gaza, but told Congress otherwise. Do you think, first of all, were you surprised at the extent of Blinken's deception? And I'll put this to Josh Paul first. And do you think that Anthony Blinken could be held liable for misleading or lying to Congress?
Yeah. So just to first further clarify your point, right? I mean, it's not even that you need experts in the State Department to tell you that Israel has been restricting humanitarian assistance into Gaza. You have, you know, scores of international NGOs, really credible organizations, you know, thousands of media reports, all of which are saying this. And it's blatantly obvious that it's happening. In fact, of course, you also have the words of Israeli officials. And so, you know, there was a report that was generated to Congress under National Security Memorandum 20, in which finally officials within the department had the opportunity to provide that same, frankly, obvious information. And yet Secretary Blinken's response or report to Congress was that, and this was back in June, was that, or May, that Israel was not restricting U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance or humanitarian assistance at all. And of course, in October, a month ago, just over a month ago now, Secretaries Blinken and Austin sent a letter to Israel telling them that they had 30 days to stop restricting humanitarian assistance. In fact, laying out 15 very clear and measurable steps that they thought that Israel needed to take to stop restricting humanitarian assistance. So it's clear that Secretary Blinken knows that they are indeed restricting humanitarian assistance. It's also clear, as we saw this week at the conclusion of those 30 days, that in the absence of Israel taking the appropriate steps, which they are required to do under international humanitarian law as the occupying power, he is unwilling to hold them accountable. He is unwilling to enforce, for example, Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act that would cut off all U.S. assistance to a country that is restricting humanitarian assistance. And of course, the U.S. is by far the major provider of security assistance, of military assistance to Israel. So I would say to your question, it certainly disappointed me. I think it surprised many who are still in the State Department. In fact, of course, Stacey Gilbert, who was one of the experts who wrote one of those memos inside the State Department, resigned because she was taken out of the process of writing that memo and didn't see the final product until it landed in Congress and said, there are no restrictions, which is the opposite of her expert opinion. So there was certainly some at surprise. I think for myself, it was just further evidence, and we continue to see that evidence, that at the end of the day, this is the policy of the Biden administration and of the Blinken State Department. And, you know, there is very little, if anything, that any level of policy expertise can do to change that. It is ultimately a political problem.
And Josh, a quick follow-up, and then Tark, what do you think then was the point of that letter from Blinken and Lloyd Austin imposing this fake 30-day deadline to ease the siege of Gaza if, as we've seen, Blinken had no interest in actually enforcing his threat?
So I'll just give three quick thoughts on that. You know, we've seen some people say that it was an election ploy. I don't think that's the case, but if it was, boy, did that not work. You know, I do think that there have been efforts throughout the course of the last year by the Biden administration and Blinken State Department to try and, you know, sort of nudge Israel as you would sort of nudge a friend who's telling a bad joke, like, hey, cut it out, without any sort of real repercussions, but just to signal that, hey, we care about the humanitarian stuff. I don't think there's any evidence that they do, but they have signaled it on several occasions, and this is an example of that. But I also understand that there have been discussions, and there were sort of indications from the International Court of Justice, the so-called World Court, in early October, that they were looking at further and continue to look at further provisional measures that would be applied because of the starvation of civilians, particularly in the north of Gaza, and that this was intended in a way to get ahead of that and to get the US out from under that. There, of course, I think as well, it has not succeeded. But we are still waiting for the ICJ to move forward on any further provisional measures.
And Tarek, same question to you. What do you think was the motive behind this threat to Israel that if you don't ease the siege of Gaza, if you don't stop blocking humanitarian aid, then we might impose some consequences, which we've seen the U.S. is not imposing at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think Josh hit it on the head, but I will not discount the level of just ill-preparedness of the political apparatus here. And it would not shock me if it was actually just a political ploy trying to get people who have been extremely frustrated and extremely like in tune with what is happening on a day to day to say like, look, we're doing the thing that you wanted and now you just have to vote for us and then it'll actually happen. I think there is a world where that was part of the calculus, whether it was like the primary driver or not. And I think just going back to earlier question to Josh, I think you had asked like, is it surprising? And like, I kind of want to add like a different perspective here, because I think at this stage, it is not surprising that like there is like no real willingness by Secretary Blinken to actually like engage on the substance. And it is absolutely like very clear that he is willfully ignoring both the law and the evidence every single time it arises. But the counterfactual for me is how strictly we adhered to the law when it came to other issues on education in particular. And when like a huge part of my portfolio is actually student debt, and the amount of litigation internally with lawyers, with the White House counsel about what we could and could not do as it like got even close to what was legally within the secretary's authority and what was not, was so intense. It took months for us to really figure out exactly how we were going to draw up certain policies to make sure that it did not even get close to encroaching like a violation of the law or an overextension of the authority. And the fact that even in that scenario, like there was no understanding that like the reason this will not actually happen is not a legal concern, it is a political concern. And we saw the Missouri AG and Republicans essentially undermine the credibility of like the authority that was given to the secretary under the laws that we use in the Higher Education Act, the HEROES Act, in a COVID era, an emergency era, to actually apply that law like legitimately and politicize it in a way that they relied on Republican appointed judges who were there specifically to prevent any progressive policies from actually helping millions of Americans. And the fact that we spent so much time thinking about how the law applies, it just is such a hypocritical position that the administration is willing to just willfully ignore what the law says and what it says so plainly here. This is not something that's really hard to really understand what the Foreign Assistance Act says about prohibiting aid from coming through or not. Like, it's pretty plain. And the fact that we're continuing over 13 months later to continue ignoring the law is just so frustrating from a person who like spent so much time working with lawyers to try and actually find a solution to like helping real people. We're actually making people's lives substantially worse because we're just not enforcing the law.
Sorry, we'll just pull the thread on that a little further, right? So we saw yesterday's State Department press conference, a Reuters reporter asked the State Department spokesperson, okay, can you say that Israel is not restricting humanitarian assistance? And he wouldn't from the podium make that clear determination either. And part of the reason for that is that it's not that there are no lawyers involved in this process, but that the law is being used, or the lawyers, I should say, are being used to find ways to avoid enforcing the law. So by not asking specific questions, has Israel violated international humanitarian law? Has Israel committed war crimes? Was X incident or Y incident a war crime? Is Israel restricting US-funded humanitarian assistance? If you, you know, work with the lawyers to find creative ways not to ask the questions, the problem is that within the law, within the United States Code, there is very little to actually trigger any sort of determination if you're not willing to do the sort of research and the findings that lead up to that determination. And that's, you know, really where we are right now, unfortunately.
So it's interesting, returning to what you just said, Tariq, before. It's not just that the Biden administration is being dishonest when they don't follow the law, but they are being dishonest when they pretend that they're being hamstrung by the law.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's like double hypocrisy, exactly. Double dishonesty, double hypocrisy. I wanted to ask both of you if you could comment on what you think the difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration will be vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine.
I think it will be a lot more clear in the messaging of a Trump administration that they're going to continue to pursue an aggressive campaign to allow Israel to do what they want to do. Like, I don't want to pretend that I know exactly what Donald Trump is going to do, but just based on the appointments that have been announced in the last couple of days, it definitely feels like a continuation of where Donald Trump and his first administration were in terms of like a fairly hawkish approach in the Middle East, a continuation of settler expansion, a close relationship with Netanyahu. Who knows what's actually going to happen, but it actually does still feel very much like this campaign to ethnically cleanse at minimum Gaza, at maximum, you know, essentially disrupting any sort of indication that there's going to be a West Bank. Like, I think there's legitimate concerns about what that is going to look like. And I think like we have to be able to just say that and be ready for what that means for the safety and security of the Palestinian people. And frankly, from our perspective, what that means for U.S. policy towards the entire region and what it means for people here at home who have family and loved ones that are still there and at risk.
Yeah, I would just follow up on that, say two things. I think, first of all, you know, the major difference when it comes to U.S. policy towards Palestine in particular, the major difference between what we saw of the Biden administration and, you know, what we've seen so far, and it's very early days, of the incoming Trump administration, is the difference between explicit and implicit. It is not a difference so far in terms of underlying policy, right? That, you know, if you have people like Mike Huckabee who will very clearly say, there's no such thing as the West Bank, you know, I support, you know, they're not called settlements, they're called, you know, villages or what have you. You know, I think it is very clear where you have Marco Rubio, who's called Palestinian savages. You know, I think there's every reason to be concerned, very concerned, about the direction things are going based on these appointments. That said, things are already pretty bad, and it's very well to have an administration that repeatedly goes out there and says, we support a two-state solution. But if you're supporting a two-state solution while providing the arms that are committing a genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza, and at the same time are doing nothing as Israel expands settlements in the West Bank, you know, how far apart are those two perspectives? I think, you know, where there might be a greater delta is here in the United States, when it comes to civil debate, civil discord around this issue. You know, certainly we have seen in the last few weeks repeatedly the Republican-controlled House try to advance legislation that would restrict the ability of Americans to protest, to criticize Israel, to organize around this issue. And I think that there are many who have concerns about where a Trump administration will go on civil rights. At the same time, you know, I don't want to say that that is the entire Republican House, because there are Republicans, including one, for example, who President Trump has nominated to be Attorney General, who take a different view, who have not supported some of that legislation. And I think that the more this moves into focus, the more, first of all, it will drive coalition building and, frankly, assist coalition building between those who care about Palestine and those who care about broader civil rights issues in the United States. And, of course, one of the many disappointments of the last year has been that those coalitions have not been quicker to form. And I think a lot of that has to do with the electoral context. But also, I think that there will also be many more voices who stand up on both sides of the aisle and, frankly, in the Republican base who say, we don't want our speech legislated. So we'll see where that all goes. But I think that's probably the greater difference as of now based on the election outcome.
Yeah. And I just want to piggyback off of that for one second, because I do think it's also, and I totally agree with Josh, I think like the actual risk, the legislation that we've seen come out in the last few months has largely been from Republicans, and Republicans having majorities in the House and Senate are probably going to prioritize pushing that legislation to repress organizing and speech. It remains to be seen if that is going to be the administration's priority. But what is clear is that what's happened on college campuses has been happening during the Biden administration, during a Democratic administration. So while, you know, a Senate Democratic majority has prevented some of the worst pieces of legislation and the worst types of repression from being codified into the law, I think we can still say that this administration's policies will be continued and probably exacerbated if those policies become law. But to be clear, I don't think that the Biden administration has done nearly enough to protect students, to protect students' ability to speak out. And so I also just want to call that out, because I think it's important that Democrats should have been doing more from the beginning. And I think that would have probably played somewhat of a role in the election in turning out progressive students and younger generations of Americans who have watched their colleagues and their peers get arrested by police on their college campuses.
And on the issue of the difference between the two inside Palestine, you have Mike Huckabee, the new U.S. ambassador to Israel, Trump's nominee for that role, you know, refusing to even refer to the West Bank as the West Bank. He refers to it as Judea and Samaria after the Jewish biblical term. But you had Bill Clinton campaigning for Kamala Harris in Michigan, saying the exact same thing and saying that Israel had to go kill all those Palestinian civilians because they had no choice. And Hamas uses everybody as human shields. And you've had under Biden, Israel announcing its biggest theft of West Bank land in almost three decades, since 1993. And that actually happened while Antony Blinken was inside Israel. An incredible embarrassment for Blinken, if he's able to be embarrassed. And let me ask you about that. I mean, the fact that Blinken has been willing to, you know, set demands on Israel that he immediately caves on. I mean, do you have any sense of inside the government, is there any discussion, putting aside the morality of facilitating a genocide, facilitating a starvation siege of Gaza, is there ever even any discussion about how this looks just in terms of the credibility of the Biden administration, repeatedly making demands that they never, ever, ever over the past year have enforced, except for that one time when they paused a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel, even after ensuring that Israel had enough 2,000-pound bombs to flatten entire Gaza neighborhoods. Is there any consideration of just how this looks for the credibility and the reputation of the Biden administration? Any concern about that?
I mean, I think that's the fundamental question, right, from a foreign policy perspective, is that even if you strip away the humanity, the morality, the harm to the Palestinian people, the suffering of the Palestinian people, and simply ask this on an American interest basis, is what we have been doing, is the approach of the Biden, Blinken, Harris administration over the last year, has it been strengthening American credibility around the world or destroying it? Has it been strengthening American relations with key partners and allies from the Middle East to Southeast Asia, to Latin America for that matter, or damaging it? The answer on all of those is that what we've been doing for the last year has been putting Netanyahu's preferences and interests above those of the United States of America. And so even if you strip away the right and the wrong, which of course you can't, but even if you were to, and simply ask, is this good for America? The answer is no. This administration's approach here has been catastrophic for America. And that, you know, coming out of the State Department, and you know, I know that many who are still in the State Department share that understanding, I think is one of the questions that history will ask about the tenure of Antony Blinken.
And I want to expand this a little bit more too, because I think Josh is exactly right. But I don't just think that it is America's credibility on a global stage either. It's also about America's credibility with its own citizens. And I think what we have seen is that we had a president and a secretary of state say for 13 months straight, we are working tirelessly for a ceasefire agreement. We are working tirelessly to get the hostages released. This is going to happen. But never actually getting there and constantly moving the goalposts, saying that there is a red line for Rafah and not actually preventing the complete destruction of Rafah, like saying that you care about civilian lives, saying that you care about humanitarian aid, not doing anything, saying that you care about international rules-based order, saying you care about international humanitarian law, not doing anything about it, time and time again, telling the American people, hey, this is what we care about, and then not actually delivering. And it goes beyond that, because then when Americans hear you say, hey, we care about student debt, hey, we care about affordable medical costs and prescription drug prices, hey, we care about labor practices, like how do they know that you're gonna actually deliver on those things? How are they supposed to believe you when you repeatedly say things and don't deliver? So I think it is bigger as well than just like what America's perception is on a global stage. It's America's perception of itself. And I think that's a huge problem and something that we're going to have to work really, really hard to salvage in the coming years, because Americans feel disconnected from their government. They don't feel represented. And on this issue, where there are millions of Americans, we've seen poll after poll after poll, Americans are saying, we want a ceasefire. We want to stop sending weapons to kill children. We don't want to see dead kids and doctors and journalists on our social media every single morning when we wake up. And you see elected officials repeatedly vote the opposite, continue to do the bidding of external interests instead of their own constituents' interests. I think it creates this disconnect from constituents and their elected officials in a way that is really, really damaging to American democracy.
And can you talk about why you founded this organization, A New Policy, and what it does?
Yeah, absolutely. And in part, it's to do exactly that. It's right. It's trying to reconnect the political system with the constituents, like connecting our politics with our interests and the values that we were all raised with. The reality is that, like, right now, and Josh said this already, but U.S. policy is not working in America's interest when it comes to Israel and Palestine. And we are seeing Americans who every single day become more and more disaffected and disconnected with our political reality. And we're building this organization, we're building A New Policy to do exactly that, to bring that voice of the American people to the halls of Congress, to elected officials, and say, look, there are people in your district who care about this issue, and to do the work that needs to be done to rebalance the political interests that have historically dismissed the grassroots, that have dismissed American voices, so that our elected officials actually know and will actually do the work of representing the interests of their constituents and of America at large.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen so many people out there protesting over the course of the last year, so many standing up on this issue. And yet we've also, both Tarek and I, have met with members of Congress and with sitting U.S. senators who behind closed doors will say, you know, what Israel is doing with our weapons is war crimes. The policies of the United States are harming ourselves. But I can't say that publicly. And they can't say that publicly because while we are all out there, you know, on the streets, in campuses, there are others who are walking in the door, in closed doors, playing in the election space, providing funding for candidates, you know, and that same funding that intimidates other elected officials from being able to speak out publicly, being afraid of being primaried. You know, we saw what happened to a couple of candidates in this yeah. cycle, Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, for example. And that is, of course, we saw what happened, of course, to Andy Levin, Jewish Democratic congressman from Michigan in the previous cycle. And so we need to take the energy, the momentum, the power, and frankly, the broad public support across America and across on a nonpartisan basis, by the way, across America. And unfortunately, we have a political system that is relatively immune to that because of decisions like Citizens United, because of the role that money and personal relationships often play in politics. So we need to take that energy from the streets and channel it into the American political system in a way in which to which the American political system will be responsive. And that's what A New Policy is trying to do. It is to expand the pool of people around the country who are supportive here, who understand these issues, and then to take the collective energy of American democracy and plug it into American politics so that we stop being complicit in war crimes, so that we stop sending our tax dollars overseas to kill babies, so that we take a balanced view and one that ends up with a just and lasting peace in the region. And that so ultimately our policies align with our interests and reflect our values.
And Josh, what about your former colleagues inside the State Department who share your concerns about U.S. support for Israel's genocide, but have stayed on? Talk to us about what things have been like for them, how they've tried to make their objections known, and whether they've been able to have any kind of impact.
Yeah. First, I will say that I'm immensely proud of so many of them. You know, look, I was in a position in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs where I was directly engaged in the questions of security assistance and arms transfers. And so for me, there was a direct nexus, a direct connection here that made me feel I had to get up, speak up, and stand up. But, you know, I think for many who are not necessarily working directly on arms transfers, right? So they're working on security assistance, on humanitarian assistance rather, or they're working on refugee issues, or they're working on broader regional policy, or they're working on, let's say, environmental issues, right? Because, you know, it's little commented, right? But Israel's bombardment of Gaza has also destroyed something like 70 to 80% of the plants, of the plant life in Gaza. I mean, it's just astonishing. Who have been working behind the scenes to try and raise these issues, to put forward memos, to try and push the administration in a better direction. You know, I was speaking to someone a few weeks ago who said, this isn't my key focus, but I have, you know, I can speak up on it a little bit, but I'm afraid if I do anything, they're just going to take me off this and they'll put someone else there. So my approach here, all I'm going to do is I'm just going to keep compiling the records so that when, you know, the declassifications happen down the line, when the history is finally written, it will be very clear exactly what the United States knew and when it knew it. And that is a form of pushing back. That is a form of standing up, even if it is not one that, that happens right now. You know, so, and I think unfortunately, right, just very quickly, what we heard from people a year ago from now, you know, back in October, November, December, was a lot more vocal. There were rallies, including civil servants. There were listening sessions within the State Department. There were dissent channel cables. None of those actually got anywhere. And that's the point at which I think a number of people have said, well, you know, I'm not having an impact. Nothing I do is working. I'm going to keep pushing back the way I am. But, you know, it's better to sort of keep my head down and just keep recording what's going on. So a lot of people have been doing that. A lot of people, of course, have resigned. And there are 13 of us who have publicly resigned. But there are, you know, at least three or four times that number who have just gotten up and left without saying so publicly. And again, there are thousands and thousands more who are just doing what they can in an impossible situation, and my heart goes out to them.
And as people who have been inside the belly of the beast, can you explain two things? One, how does this policy harm U.S. interests? And what makes the Biden administration, even after they've lost the election, what makes them so loath to do anything about Israel? Why are they so unquestioningly supportive of Israel and enabling of their genocide?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer the second question. Josh, you can take the first one if you want. We can piggyback off each other. But I mean, I think like why even in a lame duck, the Biden administration is so willing to continue to dismiss Palestinian lives ultimately comes down to decades of anti-Palestinian racism and blatant like hatred of Palestinians in a way that is like deeply, deeply rooted in America's long history of white supremacy. I feel like there's no other way to put it. Joe Biden has been around for an extremely long time in American politics. And I think that it's very clear that Joe Biden has long identified as a Zionist, but not just that. He has been willing to make exceptions for the destruction of Palestinian life in a way that I don't think we've ever seen a United States president be willing to do. And I can't think of another way of rationalizing it other than you just don't believe that Palestinians deserve life, deserve dignity, and deserve just any sort of equality or justice. And that is frankly just rooted in hate.
Yeah, I think that's right. And at the end of the day, you know, I mean, people were hopeful that, well, you know, once we're through the election, there'll be a lame duck period, and then the pressure will be off and, you know, suddenly we'll have this transformed Biden administration. And as we now see, no, we have the Biden administration that we had and we always have had, and it is not changing. And oh, by the way, I think that there's an important discussion that the Democratic Party should be having about what are the electoral consequences of sticking to those policies? What are the electoral consequences of demonstrating not only during the lead up to the election, but even when there are no stakes left, that this is your approach? And I hope that's the party, a conversation the party will have, because I think it's desperately needed if they're ever going to come back. On the damage that this approach has done to America, so we touched on that, but there's various kinds of damage, right? One is reputational and credibility, and that sounds like some sort of soft power thing that doesn't really matter. But you know, Foreign Policy magazine reported there were polls that were done in Southeast Asia, in Brunei, in Malaysia, and in Indonesia, three critical partners, and two of them very, very big populist countries with large Muslim populations, which are important, particularly in the context of U.S. strategic competition with the People's Republic of China, right? This is the sort of the big framing concept in Washington, D.C. right now, rightly or wrongly, and probably will be for at least the next decade or two to come. And in that context, we need partners and allies. And, you know, there was a poll that was done in those three countries in the summer of 2023, right, before October 7th. That said, which country around the world is your partner of choice? Which country, which major country would you most like to be allied with? And a majority in all three of those countries said the United States of America. Well, they went back and they repeated the poll this summer. And this time it was a supermajority in all three of the countries that said the People's Republic of China. And in the same poll, they asked them, what is the most important foreign affairs issue right now in the world? And in the same poll, all three countries, the majority said Gaza. So there is a clear impact on our strategic equities. Of course, at the same time, we are also doing incredible damage to our relationships in the Middle East with partners, including you know, major Arab countries who are at despair, in despair. I sat yesterday at a meeting here in Washington, D.C., where a senior person from one of those countries for half an hour unloaded and said, what are you guys doing, basically? So there is damage there. Of course, this is also, you know, what Tony Blinken keeps calling the rules-based international order, right? This framework of international law and the institutions that enable it that the United States has been the leader of and was has been key to the construction of since the end of World War II. And that gives us a world, theoretically, where prosperity can grow, where there is safety, where there is accountability. And what we have been doing over the course of the last year is to just tear that down, to rip that down, to remove any threat of accountability for war crimes, for ethnic cleansing, for genocide, to rip down the institutions like the International Criminal Court that can enforce it, to undermine the credibility of institutions like the United Nations. And at the end of the day, while some may, you know, celebrate the collapse of that order, it is an order that protects us all, including Americans, whether they are abroad or Americans and us here at home. So I think on all of those fronts, there's just been a devastating effect of the policies of the last year.
On Tariq's point about the, you know, prevailing racist contempt for Palestinians, I'm reminded of what Aaron David Miller said earlier this year. Aaron David Miller is a former senior State Department official, played a key role in the U.S. Involvement in the so-called peace process of the late 1990s, early 2000s, under most notably when he served under Bill Clinton. And he told the New Yorker magazine this. He said, if you're asking me, do I think that Joe Biden has the same depth of feeling and empathy for the Palestinians of Gaza as he does for the Israelis? No, he doesn't, nor does he convey it. I don't think there's any doubt about that. That was an admission from Aaron David Miller, you know, a very influential person, especially on this issue in Democratic circles, that Joe Biden is a bigot, that, you know, he does not have the same depth of empathy and concern for Palestinians as he does for Israelis. Imagine if it was reversed and it was said that Joe Biden doesn't have the same level of empathy and concern for Jews as he does for Palestinians. I mean, that would be a massive scandal. Biden would be forced to resign. But openly admitting that the president is a bigot toward Palestinians is treated as normal in Washington. And certainly many people on the Republican side share that same contempt as well. It's just pretty striking. In 2024, we're supposed to be an advanced society. Racism is supposed to be now not welcome. Against one group, it's widely tolerated and treated as normal.
Yeah, and let's be clear as well, right? I mean, she's not with us here on this interview, but one of the people who resigned from the state, from the U.S. government over the course of the last year, Lily Greenberg Cole, has also pointed out quite rightly that President Biden's approach here is not only deeply bigoted against the Palestinian people, it is also anti-Semitic. If you are saying that ultimately the homeland for Jews is Israel, not America, that they are not safe anywhere but in Israel, if you are essentially tying as well the reputation of the global Jewish community to the acts of the IDF and Benjamin Netanyahu, that as well is deeply anti-Semitic. And so I think there is just a witch's brew here of bigotries, of biases, of self-interests, and of political interest and political money that just makes this whole thing so ugly for so many people.
What are the things that Biden could do if he actually wanted to make any difference that Trump could not undo? And what is the most we can expect he would do? Because he's obviously not going to do the things he could do.
Yeah, if I can start on that one with my sort of, you know, pie in the sky. I mean, there are plenty of things that even in the remaining, I think it's now about 69 days that are left that President Biden could do. You know, of course, he could restrict the flow of arms. He could make these legal determinations that we started off talking about under Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act. He could designate Israeli units as having committed gross violations of human rights under the Leahy law. You know, there are, he could expand sanctions against not only, you know, a handful of violent settlers, which is what the United States has done in the last year, but against the settler councils and against Israeli government officials who have been supporting and arming settlers, including Ministers Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. And indeed, you know, we may see people calling for him to do that in the coming days. You know, I think the one thing he could do that would actually have, you know, a lot of this could be rolled back by a Trump administration if they chose to. One thing that couldn't be, which, again, I don't think President Biden is going to do almost any of these things, but one thing that could not be rolled back is, were President Biden not only to have the United States recognize Palestinian statehood, but then take that to the United Nations, where it has been the U.S. veto that has prevented U.N. Security Council recognition of a Palestinian state. Once the UN recognizes Palestinian statehood, that is not something a future administration in the United States or in any one country can roll back. That is a final determination, essentially. And what it does is it doesn't change anything on the ground, let's be clear, but it creates a balance under international law that has so far been lacking between an occupier and an occupied, between a sovereign state and an authority. And so I think that is one thing that he could do. Now, will he? Again, I think the evidence to date is no, he won't.
Josh, I wanted to ask you about something that you've been outspoken about. Kamala Harris mentioned that people were raped on October 7th. She mentioned that on the DNC. We've heard a lot of media talking about an alleged, I would say debunked, mass rape narrative that Hamas did not engage in. On a systemic level. You actually spoke about something that happened with a young man who accused Israeli interrogators of rape, and you brought that to the Israeli government. Can you talk about that story and what happened?
Yeah, so this was back in, I believe it was 2021, 2022, a non-governmental organization called Defense of Children International, which is a global organization, and specifically its branch in Palestine, Defense of Children International Palestine, brought to the world's attention the story of a boy who was detained by Israel in a detention center called the Muscovia in Jerusalem and was then raped by his prison guards. The State Department has a process to look at allegations of gross violations of human rights by Israeli forces. We can get into that. It's a pretty peculiar process that has actually never resulted in any Israeli security forces being designated as having committed unremediated gross violations of human rights. But in any event, looked at that case, thought that the reporting there was credible. And then, unfortunately, this is another thing unique to that process for Israel, reached out to the government of Israel to ask them about it, to say, have you seen this report? What is your response to it? The very next day, Israeli Defense Forces went into the offices of that charity, Defense of Children International Palestine, and confiscated all of their computers. And then a few months later, banned the organization, claiming that it was a terrorist entity. So this is, I think, you know, we've seen now in the last year, you know, people at the time, particularly when I first told that story, which was in December of last year, this was the first time that anyone had heard, in many cases, particularly those who weren't paying attention, of any sort of use of sexual violence by the government of Israel in its detention centers. What we've seen in the last year is that actually that behavior is widespread. We've seen in the Israeli detention center that they created in the Negev desert there, multiple reports of rape of Palestinian detainees. And in fact, officials within the Israeli government celebrating those rapes, saying that this is the right of the occupier. This is, this demonstrates some sort of, power and all this kind of thing. Even in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, people endorsing this sort of behavior. Just as troubling, I would say, I've heard also in the course of the last year from Palestinians of an older generation who reached out to me quietly and said, I saw the story you told about this boy who was raped, and I haven't said this to anyone, and it was 30 years ago, but that happened to me as well. And so I think we have not only the evidence before our eyes of what Israel has publicly admitted that has been happening in its detention centers this year. We know that it was happening beforehand, and possibly for a very long time. And so, this all, of course, as well, just underlines the dehumanization of the Palestinian people. Because as we know, rape at the end of the day is a tool of violence. It is a tool of dehumanization. It is not a sexual act, it is a power act. And it is one that is applied against people who one sees as being lower. And I think, the increase we see in Israel's use of it and the use of it by Israeli defense forces and Israeli security forces points to where their perception has been going. But I think we have to trace that back and see that it is not new and has been a behavior for a very long time.
And I also want to point out that you told that story on Christiane Amanpour's show on CNN. So it's not like you told it on some, independent media outlet. And yet none of the people ranging from media elites like Dana Bash and Jake Tapper to Sheryl Sandberg, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, who claim to care about sexual violence, have mentioned it, even pretended to care about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Israel has been very effective in telling the narrative that it wants to tell, right? And so, for example, for literally 6 months after October 7th, every week there was a showing in Congress of a film that Israel made about the horrific events of that day. And let's again be clear, there were many horrific events, murders, and rapes that occurred. But it gets this emotional response out of people that sort of crowds out any sort of suffering of the Palestinian people. And so for the, 1,200 Israelis who were killed, there are now 50,000, some estimates say 200,000, possibly more Palestinians who have been killed. And there just isn't the same willingness to humanize those stories, to tell those stories, to feel that pain. And again, I think this points to a bigotry, not only, as we were saying within the Biden administration, but across a lot of our media.
And Tara, can you tell me about your family's connection to Palestine?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned, I'm Palestinian American, but both my parents were born in Palestine, and my dad's family originally is from Jaffa. And in 1948, just before he was born, his parents, my grandparents, and my aunts and uncles, his brothers and sisters, were all forcibly expelled from their home. I remember stories that my aunt and my grandma would tell me about that time. My grandpa had just built their new home just within a year of having to leave. And, at first they thought like, oh, we'll be gone for a little bit, but we'll get to come back. And that never happened. And it's been 76 years. And even now, my grandparents have now passed, my aunts and uncles are much older, and they still remember, growing up in Jaffa, having neighbors who were Muslim, neighbors who were Jewish, playing in the streets, being near the water. It's just so devastating to know that the experience that they had so many years ago, having to leave everything that they had ever known behind, leaving all of their possessions, leaving their home, leaving their loved ones, losing their loved ones, is happening again. And is happening at such a huge magnitude that it's just absolutely unfathomable.
Yeah, you have Israelis who both deny that there ever was a Nakba, and then they say this is the second Nakba, like in a way that they're like threatening and proud of. It's really incredible. And you and your family is Christian, right?
Yeah, my family for generations has been Palestinian Christian, and for many Christians out there who are really invested in their faith and in the history of their faith, like Palestine is where Christianity was born, and so. Like the fact that we're so willing to erase Palestinian Christians from the reality of like who Palestinians are is so so problematic in so many different ways. And the fact that, the infrastructure of like American Zionism is largely rooted in Christian Zionism is actually really, really really problematic, because the willingness of Christian Zionists to also erase Palestinian Christians, their own brothers and sisters in the same faith that they believe, because it plays into their anti-Semitic like understanding and views and beliefs of what needs to happen for their quote unquote salvation. It's really just.
Yeah, they throw obviously Palestinian Christians under the bus, and then they want people like me to go back to Israel so most of us can be most of us will be killed, and like a small number can convert and get to survive, and the rest burn for eternity. These are the people who spoke at the pro-Israel demonstration that was attended by Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, which is insane. Pastor Hagee.
People who are largely funding the pro Netanyahu right-wing agenda of the Israeli government. It's like it's largely being pushed and led by Christian Zionists.
Right. And Schumer claims to not like Netanyahu, and he appears with these people. And of course, it's the reason that they have to erase Palestinian Christians is it's not convenient for the narrative that this conflict is about two old religions that just don't get along, and two cultures that just don't get along, Muslims and Jews. And as he pointed out, they've been coexisting for centuries, and also there are Christians there too. So if this were just about a Muslim-Jewish clash, which it's not, but even for argument's sake, if it were, that wouldn't explain why Palestinian Christians are being killed.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Like the reality is this is actually not a like longstanding religious war that, has no solution in sight because it's complicated and it's rooted in beliefs. It's actually like far from that. This is about land. This is about dispossession. This is about occupation. This is about unequal treatment of people based on their ethnicity, their nationality. It actually is not about religion. And the fact that Palestinians are Christian and Muslims and Jews, like, kind of like breaks that mold in a way that like you can't put it back into their narrative that like, well, this is why this is happening. This is why it has to look like this. Like it actually like disrupts the status quo that has really been shaped into American perception of Israel.
We really appreciate you both for everything you've done, for continuing to speak out as you now launch this new organization, a new policy. Any closing remarks do you want to leave us with? Tarek, starting with you.
Yeah, I just thank you again so much for having us. I really appreciate the conversation. I will say, like, for anyone who's interested to learn more about our organization, what we're working on, what we're building, please go to our website, sign up for our newsletter, donate if you feel empowered to. Our website is www.anewpolicy.org.
Yeah, I'll just say in closing, look, this is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. You don't turn the ship of American foreign policy overnight. It's going to take several election cycles. The important thing is to continue to push, to continue to raise our voices, and to remember that there is more to politics than elections. Politics requires continuous engagement, both with your elected officials in the public space, in the public square, and through organizations, whether they be student organizations, organizations like A New Policy. This is going to require constant effort and long-term effort, but we've got to believe that it is possible, and we will get there.
Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Very grateful to Tara Kabash and Josh Paul for joining us. And again, their website for their new organization, A New Policy, is anewpolicy.org. And, you know, it's one thing when you have people out in the streets protesting genocide. It's very important. But it's so significant when you have former officials who've been on the inside, who see how policy is made, speaking out. And it's not easy, especially to give up your career, as, you know, many of these people have done. Inside government, to take a stand on such a contentious issue, that where if you do speak out, you are setting yourself up for smear attacks, for lost opportunities in the future. But sometimes people are moved to do the right thing, and very grateful to everybody involved in this new organization, A New Policy, for doing the right thing, for speaking out against genocide.
Definitely, and they're both really brave, and I really commend them. And again, thank them for doing what they do. And also for talking to us, because that was a really fascinating conversation.
It's very brave to speak to us.
The bravest, yeah, true.
We are making the entire interview this week free, no paywall, because we want everyone to see this. And we hope you got something from it. And we hope you continue to support the show. UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com is our website. Support the show, get bonus content, and keep us going.
And of course, you have this week's amazing Thursday Throwdown, where we help you laugh instead of cry at the news. And that's your midweek dose of media madness. And that is something that will be very cathartic for you, for our paid members.
All right. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at UsefulIdiotPod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.